So, Robert Kelsey joins us from London to talk about his book, What's Stopping You? Why Smart People Don't Always Reach Their Potential and How You Can. Coming up next on Bookcasting. This is the Bookcasting Podcast, Episode 10, recorded September 26, 2012. A podcast with a guest you know talking about a book you will love. From Oslo, Norway, I am Tom Erik Sturve. And?
And I'm Ola.
Excellent.
Yeah. Today we have a guest with us, Robert. Hi, Robert.
Hello, good evening.
So, your book is called What's Stopping You? Why Smart People Don't Always Reach Their Potential and How You Can. And it's a quite personal book, is it not?
It is very personal. It's very much from the heart, this book. Yes, no doubt about it.
Yeah, we like that. And we're very excited to have you on all the way from somewhere around London.
Yeah, in London. Yeah, very much in London. East London, Hackney.
Yeah. So you are basically running a PR agency for financial companies now. That's what you do.
That is what I do. Yes, I'm having had about a million careers, all of which seem to end in failure. I finally became a bit of an entrepreneur and set up my own financial PR company for banks mainly, and yeah, that's gone okay. Yeah, it seems to be it's about 10 years old and it's doing all right.
Yeah. Tom Erik here, he heard about you through Scanners Night, and you were there and presenting.
Yes, I did a talk on overcoming fear of failure, and it's called The 7 Steps to Overcoming Fear of Failure, which also appears in the book. Yeah, it's basically a talk that that takes us through what fear of failure is, how to understand it, and how to accept it as part of you, and then how to overcome some of the consequences that it brings with it. So that's pretty much what the book's about, and pretty much what that talk was about as well.
Yeah, so that's we are very interested in that in Norway in particular.
Very good. Is it a Norwegian problem, you think, fear of failure? Or?
Well, it's. Have you ever been here?
I've not. I've been to Scandinavia, but I've not managed to make it to Norway. I apologize for that.
So, where did you go?
Well, I've been to Sweden a couple of times, and I've been to Denmark. Never quite managed to get to Norway. And I realize it's a major gap. You're not very far away from us, and I should. It's something that it always looks very stunning, I have to say, in the in all the photos. So I will get there.
Absolutely, you should get here, and I will now tell you why. We are very much like the Swedes and the Danes, but there are some major differences. The Swedes are very good at organizing and preparing.
Right.
We're not.
And
that's, if you're a little bit afraid of failing, yes, it will help to prepare.
Yes, I think that's
organize.
Right. Yeah, well, being poorly organized and procrastination and things like that are often elements of fear of failure. There's no doubt about it. It can be a major symptom of fear of failure, procrastination particularly, especially. And also being poorly organized, there's an element known as sort of self-sabotage. And being poorly organized can be very much a part of self-sabotage. I would take task with you, though, saying that it was any kind of national trait. I think that often people can hide behind sort of national traits when there's always a grain of truth in there, but I think that you can't tell me that everyone in Norway is disorganized and everyone in Sweden is organized. I think that's if it is a trait, and it almost becomes self-fulfilling, I think, in the end, those sort of things.
But you do quote Pink Floyd yourself in the book, right? Saying,
I do, yes.
Desperation is the English way.
Yes, yeah. Quiet desperation is the English way. I guess, again, it is a trait, but, I very much think it's not a unique one. One thing I would say about the book, actually, is it was, a lot of people say to me, it's written very much for a British audience. And it's because I use a lot of that sort of Californian self-help, Anthony Robbins, Stephen Covey type stuff, and I kind of interpret it for a British audience. So it's very much more reserved, because I think the Californian sort of way kind of overpromises a bit. But what I often say to that isn't that it is. When I talk about a British audience, I mean that kind of British type of audience. It's not, you don't have to be British to appreciate it, and you don't have to, it's not that if you're not British you won't appreciate it. If you have that kind of reserve, if you kind of bottle things up a bit, and everybody, an awful lot of people do that, whether they're British or not, it's just seen as a bit of a British trait. You could almost say, if you're a Californian, you'd probably think of it as a bit of an East Coast or New England traits. I think that but nonetheless, the book was aimed at that kind of reserved sort of person that may not really be quite as open at confronting some of their insecurities as they should be. There's that reserve that the British are supposed to have, and it's kind of supposed to be dealing with that. So that's what that's about, that element. So, but I think if you're a sort of high-fiving Californian, you may go on. Sorry.
Yep. So, Tomek, do you think that maybe Norwegians also can be a little reserved?
Definitely. Well, so I can only speak for myself, I guess, and I have to say that the concept of high fear of failure really resonated with me, and I guess I didn't know about it before I read your book, Robert. But I feel like I'm a recovering
recovering IFF. IFF.
So I used to work in sales in IT, and I just remember the procrastination, and it's terrible.
It is. It's very strange that I fear failure. How it comes about and how it is really conditioning from childhood that seems to induce it. And I mean, it was a revelatory read for me. I mean, my own background is that I'm not a psychologist or I'm a neurologist or anything like that, or even a coach. I was simply a sufferer. I was somebody that was just trying to work out what on earth was going on and why I just couldn't seem to make progress in my life and couldn't seem to muster the courage in order to take these great leaps. I just couldn't seem to do it, and I'd get to the brink of a leap and not take it and procrastinate, as you say. And it was just simply trying to work out why that was occurring that I came across fear of failure as a concept, and it slightly died out in fact as a psychological phenomenon, because it was based on a lot of experiments that were done in the 1960s, in fact, in Stanford University in California. And it was a guy called John Atkinson, another one called David McClellan, and they came up with this concept of fear of failure. And it was actually reading an old psychology textbook from the 70s that I found in a dusty old secondhand bookshop out in East Anglia, and it was that sort of opened my eyes to this. And I was obviously keen to find out what on earth was wrong with me, and it was just a revelatory read. And so I went deeper and deeper into it, and then realized that actually there was a major gap between what the psychologists said about our insecurities and our fears and how innate they are and how they're based on conditioning, and what the sort of high five, hot coal walk self-help types were saying. And it made a lot of sense to me suddenly that the reason I was reading these sort of self-help books, I won't name names, but thinking that I could suddenly achieve all my goals, and then 2 or 3 months later wasn't any further forward didn't seem to, you know, make any difference. And of course, you picked up some tips, but you weren't changed, you weren't cured. And the reason it was occurring was because of psychological flaws that I wasn't born with, but were based on early life conditioning and things that happened to me in my childhood that had given me fears, certain fears, and one key fear being was the fear of public humiliation. And fear of failure actually is at its root a fear of public humiliation. And so once you start understanding that, you start realizing that, you know, all those self-help books that tell you you can reach for the stars and have it all, well, you know, fine, but and some of their methodologies are very useful, but they're overpromising a bit because they're not dealing with you and the psychologically flawed character that is you and will remain you. That is that. You are, you know, if you have fear of failure, you are, you know, you are psychologically flawed, and you can either try and cure yourself, which will end almost certainly in failure, or you can accept that and try and move on and try and navigate it. And actually also accept that in some cases it can work to your advantage. And that was the sort of revelation I had. Hence my inspiration to kind of write a book about it, really. Just trying to marry these two elements that seem to be absolutely at loggerheads with each other.
So just to give our listeners an idea of what a high FF is. Can you say a little bit about how high FFs choose goals?
Yes, well, let's go back to John Atkinson and these experiments, I just thought they were so extraordinary when I read about them, and he did experiments on children who were the children largely of either students or workers at Stanford University. And he set them reward-based tasks. And so if they, you know, did a certain task, they could win a reward, probably candy or something like that. And one of the tests he set them was a game of hoop the peg, and he noticed that where you basically stand a distance from the peg with a hoop and you try and throw the hoop on the peg, very simple game. And he said okay, the further you stand back from the peg, the more reward you will get. And and he noticed that the kids divided into two very distinct groups, and one group which he called people that had a need for achievement, NARCs they were known as, the need for achievement, and the people I then called in the book high AMs, or high achievement motivated, or people with high achievement motivation, sorry. And what they did was that they would be focused on the reward. They would absolutely see the reward and want that reward, and they would stand a challenging but realistic distance from the peg in order to maximize the amount of reward that they would get. And then the other group, the high fear of failure group, were not focused on the reward, even though the reward was offered. They were focused on the concept of failure, and they were worried about the failure. So either what they would do is stand right on top of the peg, or, and this was the extraordinary bit, they'd stand so far back from the peg that they would almost certainly fail to hoop the peg, and certainly fail not to win any award or reward. But it masked their fear of humiliation by standing so far back. So what was happening was they were either standing on top of the peg or standing miles back in order that everybody would miss at that distance, but they would win some kudos for being seen as a trier at that distance. And that went into various other experiments, but other people got involved. A woman called Carol Dweck got involved, and she did similar experiments and divided kids that into either being mastery focused in that they wanted to get on top of a skill, or ego focused in that they didn't want to lose face. Their concern was that they didn't want to lose face. That was their main worry. And then there were various other experiments that confirmed that there was this huge divide between people that wanted to achieve something and were focused on the achievement, or the reward of the achievement, and people that weren't so focused on the achievement, but were focused on the concern they had about humiliation if they didn't achieve it. And that drove how they went about goal setting or went about trying to achieve something, in that basically they knew they wouldn't achieve it. They approached it knowing they wouldn't achieve it, and lo and behold, proved themselves right. But also, they were the key thing they were concerned about was humiliation. And one of the extraordinary things about this was that if you set if you think about the go back to the hoop the peg game, and you think about people that stand miles back from the peg and throw the hoop from as far back as possible, well, actually, that does have a resonance when it comes to career choice. And you can think about the high AMs, the achievement motivated people would sort of choose careers like, I don't know, going into the professions, which were challenging careers, but they didn't have low rewards. They had high rewards, but they were challenging careers, but they were realistic. You know, there's a lot of lawyers out there. There were things you could do. And whereas the high FF kids, the people with fear of failure, would choose things like becoming a pop star or a TV presenter or something, become some huge famous person, because they knew that it was extremely unlikely that that was going to happen, that they would do that. But they had masked their fear of failure of choosing achievable goals and not achieving them. Because if you're in a class of kids where half of them say they want to be lawyers or whatever, and you know, one or two don't make it as a lawyer, and that's pretty humiliating. But if you're in a class and you say, right, I'm going to be the pop star, absolutely, I'm going to be the pop star, and you don't make it as a pop star, you're still a pretty cool guy. You're still the people that people want to know. So you've masked your fear of failure, and that's so you can see that's how the whole goal setting dynamic occurs. And I just had a huge resonance with that. When I read that, I just thought, that's absolutely me. That's absolutely spot on. You know, so that did it for me. I went some distance trying to become a building surveyor and sort of realized it was going to be difficult. And when it was easy, I did it when I was working. And then when I went to college to try and do it, realized it was quite difficult, and then found a way of dropping out, you know, and things, you know, I wanted to go and write my novel and things like that. And so I always had this kind of writing superstardom kind of bug. And you know, which obviously hasn't quite gone away, but you can see that the huge difference between someone with fear of failure and someone with achievement motivation when it comes to goal setting. So does that answer your question?
I think it answers a lot of questions.
Yes, bit of a long one. Sorry.
No, that was perfect. We're going to take a break. And then afterwards, you're gonna read a little bit from your book, and
yep.
Then hopefully we'll have time to talk a little bit about what you can do with your fear of failure, let's say.
Great.
Audible.com. That's actually where we listen to your book. Are you on Audible yourself, Robert?
No, I'm not. Never heard of it.
You never heard of it? Well, your book is on Audible. So basically, what happened is that I heard about your book from John Williams, his newsletter. For our listeners, you can get Robert's book for free, actually, right now on Audible. With a 30 day trial, or as any other book, on Audible, get one book for free. Actually, do you have a book that you would recommend other than your own book for our listeners, Robin?
I often get asked this, actually. People say, what was the most, single most influential book? And I think there was a lot of psychology texts, but I think the one, the self-help book I always really like is Stephen Covey, 7 Habits. I think that's pretty good, actually. There's a lot of Stephen Covey in What's Stopping You.
I
really like that one. I think there's a really good reason, and it's because he talks about the character ethic rather than the personality ethic. He's sort of very anti these modern self-help books that can change your personality. And
right.
And I pretty much agree with that.
Right. So actually, we had an author on last week too, Serena Star Leonard, from Australia or right. from New Zealand, I guess. That was also her pick.
Oh wow,
so that's good.
Well, obviously Stephen Covey sadly died recently, so it's. So I think he's probably it's that classic thing when the pop star dies and all his records end up in the charts.
So actually,
I think it's the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So I do have it in my reading list. Actually, I just haven't.
Right.
I guess I've postponed it.
Yeah, yeah. That's procrastination. Again.
Yeah. Exactly. So I guess we have to do the book on this podcast soon, if all our guests keep recommending it.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, if the trouble is you're going to have trouble getting hold of Stephen Covey now.
Yeah, exactly.
But it might be a bit late. Sorry, that's a bit of an off-color joke. But
we'd have to call up someone else to pretend, I guess.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
All right. So we have this. I guess you could actually get your free audiobook too.
I guess so. Yeah. So it's the sort of thing you join, is it? Like
So we actually have our own address that you can go to for the free book, which is audibletrial.com/bookcasting.
Very good.
And there you can go. You can get Seven Habits, or you can get What's Stopping You. I guess you won't get that one, or maybe you could.
I want to hear if it's the audio book. I want to hear what the voice sounds like.
Yeah, because you haven't heard it.
No,
all of the voice talents on Audible sound the same to me because I put them on double or even triple speed.
No, very interesting. That's very clever.
Yeah. Okay, audibletrial.com/bookcasting.
Yeah.
How does the book start, Robert?
Depends if you mean the intro or chapter one. Chapter one. Okay. Well, chapter one is really it goes into my history as an investment banker, and I was a really appalling investment banker. And this is before we realised that there were lots of appalling investment bankers out there. But and it was really just I used it to explain my fear of failure and how fear of failure kind of operates in a real world sort of environment, so that people could sort of relate to it. And it just showed you that I was actually quite I was a journalist previously to that, and I was actually quite a reasonably confident and competent journalist, and that led me to a sort of arrogance, a hubris, if you like, that meant that I thought that I could become an investment banker and was bluffed my way into becoming an investment banker, which all sounds very unfear of failure like, but actually it takes you back to the hoop, the peg in the hoop and the furthest peg, etc. And then just the minute I got in that bank, my behavior just completely changed, and was completely dictated by an enormous fear of public humiliation, based on just sort of this idea that you know I just felt like an imposter, and I was going to be found out any minute, and it was just it was so it really just goes into detail about how this particular career path I took led to disaster in that respect, and it led to and it was all based on fear of failure, and it's just that's how it gets into it, really. That's how we open the topic.
So then I have to ask them, Eric, was there where you kind of felt at home?
Where?
I'm asking Tom Erik, if Tom Erik, hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Was that where you kind of felt that, yeah, that could have been me?
Well, sort of all over the place.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's what we agreed upon was the interesting thing about the book, was that Tom Erik really felt that this was, the book was talking to him.
Yeah. Well, because you know, I guess I've found ways of dealing with it on my own before I read the book, but I really see myself from before, right? Now I have ways to kind of put words on some emotions that I have in certain situations, even today, in my job or elsewhere, which I didn't really understand before. It's like, is it just me, or are there other people who
That's
feel
right.
the same way?
Yeah. Well, there's a big old thing called imposter syndrome, where you're sitting around the table and you're sitting there thinking, you know, what am I doing here? I'm the imposter. Everyone else seems to know what they're doing, and I don't. And and you could all be thinking that, and but you're keeping it to yourself, and it's known as imposter. Well, it's been actually officially known as imposter phenomenon.
I want to know how many meetings there are at any given time that where all the people around the table are actually thinking that.
Yes, they think that they're imposter. I certainly did it as an investment banker. I was just waiting for the moment that someone would just put their hand on my shoulder and actually say, "You just don't know what you're doing
What are you doing here?" there was one thing that I wanted to ask you. So I'm picking up from your book that you there's a dichotomy in a way that you can put. Like every person into one or the other group.
Yes. Several people have picked up on this. Go on.
So, but I'm guessing that you do this for to make a point. But do you feel that some people may have degrees of fear of failure?
It's complete spectrum. I mean, you have to, you know, you have to paint in primary colors when you're doing this sort of thing. You can't, you know, I think you've got to make a bold statement. But there's no doubt there's a complete spectrum. I mean, there are, you know, I think that people, how full is the middle, if you like? That's the interesting question. What does the curve look like? Is it a U or a bell or, you know, I don't know. I really don't know what that curve looks like in terms of how you'd place people along the extremity of fear of failure. But, possibly the people at Stanford who came up with this stuff in the 60s may have a better idea than me. My guess is that the middle, it's more of a U, in that there is some people in the middle along the spectrum. But I think that what would happen is that once you were in this, in one camp or another, self-fulfilling behavior would start pushing you further and further into the extremes. So that would be my view, is that sure, there are people in the middle, but if you had high achievement motivation and you went for the reward, say, and you achieved that reward, then that's going to reinforce your achievement motivation. So that's going to move you up towards the AM, the high AM end. And if you had fear of failure, and then you were concerned about missing the peg, and so you did avoidance behavior in order to not participate in the game, then that's going to have a self-confirming aspect to it, and I think so. That's going to push you down into the fear of failure element. So I, you know, while I think there is a spectrum, and people are always saying this to me, surely there's just a spectrum here. I agree, there probably is a spectrum, but I think that you would. It's not a bell curve where that most people are crowded in the middle here. I think it is a U curve in which most people are crowded at either end, and of course there's people in the middle. But I've got zero evidence for that. But it might well be, and it might well be that the people at Stanford, John Atkinson was still alive, be good to ask him about these kids and say, well, how did it, what was the, did you plot each, the numbers? But I've never seen it plotted. So I would, it'd be really interesting to see, I agree. But my guess is it goes to each end, I think. But simply because once you start in that behavior, I think that you then travel a path in that direction, and so that's why I think it's difficult to be a bit fear of failure and a bit achievement motivated. I think that you will tend to fall in one or other camp.
Right, and you also say that it has a lot to do with self-fulfilling attitudes.
Yes.
So if you start going down that road, then it will just
enforces itself.
That's
a key point here, I think, is that it is self-fulfilling. A lot of what you self-fulfilling, if you walk into a room expecting failure, then lo and behold, failure is what's going to happen. Of course, how could it not?
The monkey on my back.
Yes, that's you. Do you want me to read a bit?
That'd be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, we are. It's in the introduction, this bit. So it's early on, and it's in a passage that's headed "The Monkey on My Back." And it goes, "I have suffered from a debilitating fear of failure all my life, itself the result of poor confidence brought about by a low self-esteem developed in early childhood. At key moments in my life, fear has led me to doubt my abilities to succeed, which has profoundly changed my behavior in ways that made success less likely, often snatching a humiliating defeat from the jaws of victory. And I have read scores of books in an effort to shift what I call the monkey on my back, the creature that whispers fear and self-doubt in my ear at critical moments. But the monkey hasn't disappeared. In fact, there was no shifting him, which didn't seem to compute with the literature I was reading, much of which promised both a cure for my insecurities and the certainty of dream fulfillment. Clearly I was doing something wrong, perhaps not applying the methodology diligently enough or maintaining destructive behaviors and beliefs. Yet I now realize it was their prognosis that was flawed because it took too little account of the fact I am who I am, and that monkey comes too. Surely a more powerful book would describe a route towards progress from our own flawed perspective, answering the question, what's stopping you? With the answer, you are, and the monkey, of course. Yet it would also state that we must accept the monkey as a fellow passenger and plan to make progress anyway. It would spot and describe the likely barriers preventing progress as well as the false assumptions they may generate. Certainly, if we could see that it was our responses to those barriers that were producing the poor results, not the barriers themselves, nor was it poor luck, innate ineptitude, or even prejudice against us, then we may be able to generate better results. We don't need a miracle cure or injected into us. We just need to take account of our insecurities and navigate our way forward accordingly. So that's that passage.
Yep. So,
the monkey comes too, guys.
Say again.
I said the monkey comes too. I think it's the absolute difference between my book and just about every other self-help book out there is I will tell you the monkey comes too. The monkey on your shoulder is coming with you.
Yeah.
You're not going to get rid of him. And that's the absolute difference. Everyone else is telling you that how you can get rid of the monkey, and I'm telling you, you can't. And once you've got to cross that threshold and realize that. I did a talk last night to about sort of 60 people in a room, and a woman at the end of it, it was about overcoming your insecurities, and the woman at the end of it said to me, she was really fed up with my talk. She said, I can't believe what you've just told me. That she said, I've had these insecurities for 30 years, and you're telling me they're never going to go away. And said, I came to this talk to to be curious.
That's why I'm here.
She wanted her money back, I think. But she'd kind of missed the point in that I was saying that's the revelation. That's what you need to know, is that the insecurities are going to be with you for the rest of your life. So what are you going to do? Are you going to allow them to destroy you, to disable you, or are you going to accept them as part of you and navigate your way forward anyway, knowing that that's part of you? Because at the moment, what happens is you keep going back to square one in an attempt to cure yourself. And if you say, okay, there's no cure, then immediately that makes you take steps forward. But one of the reasons you're not taking any steps forward now is because you're going round and round and round in circles waiting for the cure. It's not coming, guys. That's the key difference between sort of me and a lot of the other self-help stuff out there.
So I have to say that I've had the pleasure of being coached by a professional coach, and he has the same kind of philosophy, but he doesn't call it the monkey, he calls it the CD player in your head, yes, always talking you down.
Yes, I've heard about that. There's a lot of them. There was another one called, oh no, in fact there is, I mean, you know, Susan Jeffers, she wrote Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway, and she talked about the chatterbox. So, there's various versions of this. There's no doubt.
And he and he also says, I actually had lunch with him on Monday, and we were talking a little bit about the CD player, and he just said, you know, it's never going to go away. You just have to accept that it's there.
Yeah.
And I, yeah, that's really, that's been really helpful to me.
Yeah, you know, it's revelatory, I think, and I think that once you've got to cross that threshold, and but you know, I mean, it, well, I'm glad to hear, you know, that that's what a coach is telling you, because there's an awful lot of them out there that don't tell you that, and I have to say, one of the sort of subgroups of that I get a lot of criticism from are the people that do neurolinguistic programming, and you know, the whole NLP thing, and I think that that. You know, NLP is very useful in a lot of ways. And I there's some stuff in there that I use, like visualization and things like that, which I really like. But you know, the idea that you are going to become a new person is it's just not going to happen. And actually what's happening is that you're injecting somebody else's personality traits into you. It's a false premise. And you know, eventually the mask will slip. It's a delayed reckoning when you're further down the line. So, you know, I think, and the trouble is, an awful lot of self-help books now are based on NLP in one form or another. An awful lot are, and I think that's a bit of an issue for the self-help industry, I have to say. I think it's been, I wouldn't say hijacked, that's too strong a word, but I think it's become a bit dominated by NLP, and you know, and I, there is, to be honest, there is a bit of a reaction to it, but you know, and I consider myself part of that reaction.
You do offer some advice on how to I guess cope with the monkey.
Oh yeah.
And just one of the things that I kind of underlined, or just to talk a little bit about, if it's okay, Ura.
Yeah.
So how are you with time now, Robert?
I'm fine now. I can bang on all night about this.
Sounds great. So you talk a lot about being proactive, right?
Yeah.
And I guess, could you say a little bit about that? What does it mean to be proactive in the sense tell the monkey before the monkey tells you?
Yeah, well, I think you clearly have to act. I think the most disabling thing that happens, the most disabling result of fear of failure is inaction, you know, and so you clearly have to act. And so, you know, so you have to work out a way in which you move from inaction to action. And of course, if you move, it's so easy to say that. And then, you know, but it's so difficult to do that. You have to come up with some kind of mental process that helps you in order to do it. And one of the things I come up with is it's about depersonalization. We're talking about fear of failure, and what is fear of failure? Well, it's fear of public humiliation. So it's not the failure that is the critical issue. It's the public humiliation that failure generates that is the critical issue. So one of the aspects that I recommend people adopt is what I call depersonalization, in that you should become a company. You should become Me Limited or Me Inc. Robert Kelsey Limited, and become a company. And that company, so it's not about you anymore, it's about your company. And but what does a company have? What's different to you and a company? Well, a company has objectives. It has a mission, so that's what a company has. It has goals, and it has a strategy for achieving those goals, and it uses tactics in order to achieve its strategy. So you have to start thinking and acting like a company. But one of the things about a company is that the companies don't aren't stationary vehicles. They don't just sit there. Companies progress. They move forward. Every year they have to produce accounts and a balance sheet and a P&L and et cetera. So they have to progress. Companies are either growing or they're shrinking. You know, they don't stay still. So you don't stay still. Your company, your Me Inc., doesn't stay still. It makes progress. But it needs a structure in which to make progress, like any company does. And so that's that, you know, for me, I think it was just a mental leap in terms of how you thought about things, as if you could sort of structure things so that you were a company and thought and acted like a company. So, and also what you notice when things go wrong at a company is that it's not the end of the road. It's just you sort of pick yourself up and you start again. You know, failures happen to companies all the time. You know, they're not, you know, sure there's bankruptcies, but most failures with companies are just, you know, small little setbacks, and you work it out, you know, and then start again and carry on. And that, and so it's just a way of mentally processing, how you should make progress. What's going on? Is there someone in the bathroom or something?
this is America, you know. So I read some of Daniel Goleman's books.
Oh yes.
Yeah, and he is very keen on Buddhist monks.
Oh yes.
Yeah, so they have their own solution to this, which is basically meditation, where you practice to just let the thoughts just float by, basically.
I think they
have
call
you tried
it mind.
It?
Yeah, no, I, well, no, I haven't tried it, but they call it mindfulness now, I think, and. Yeah. I like the idea of it. There's a new book I'm writing, it's coming out pretty soon, and it's on confidence, and it's called What's Stopping You Being More Confident. So it's the sort of follow up. Yeah. And one of
When's
the things it's coming in December or January, around there. I'm not quite sure. Be out in December. It's called What's Stopping You Being More Confident. And one of the chapters, the last element of it, is barriers, what I consider barriers to confidence. And actually one of the key barriers is stress. And I then get into mindfulness there, and about how you can use mindfulness to overcome stress. Whenever I've been very, very stressful, I've adopted certain techniques, and I found out that they were very similar to the mindfulness concept of being very in the moment, if you like. That's how they describe it, and I really like it. I think it's absolutely brilliant. I'm not a Buddhist. I'm not a practitioner of mindfulness, but you know, I saw that there was a lot of positive aspects to it. You know, I get, one of the criticisms I get is that I'm very unspiritual. I get a lot of, I'm very practical. It's just practical, practical, practical. I'm not a spiritualist in any shape or form, except I do like things like visualization, but I don't think it's visual. I think it's a practical exercise. And I like things like mindfulness, but I think they're very practical. I don't think you have to grab onto any kind of spiritualism in order to use them. Having said that, you know, whatever floats your boat, whatever gets you there, I'm not saying don't be spiritual. I'm just not. Mine is a much more practical route.
So, how would you then, position the NLP and the mindfulness in, you know, how would you compare the two of them? Would you say that they are different, or it's the same kind of?
Oh, blimey. Well, NLP is, I mean, it aims to be very, obviously very practical. I mean, I like, I called NLP CBT on steroids. Do you know CBT, cognitive behavior?
Yeah.
And I really like CBT. I thought it was very good and it's really one of the where I come in a bit, is that when I got very depressed, I found myself being coached extraordinarily, it was at a sexual health clinic in London, and it just shows you the extraordinary concept that is the NHS in this country, and that you can find yourself being coached in a sexual health clinic with using CBT techniques. But but that's where I found myself, and it sort of opened my eyes to some of this stuff, and to reframing and to questioning some of your self beliefs and all that stuff. And I really liked CBT. I thought it was great. I think NLP takes it a step slightly too far, because what it's saying is it's not just about how you process things and about how you compute things in your mind. It's actually about, it then turns it round and actually tries to influence the person you're talking to, or the person you're negotiating with, or whatever, by mirroring or by, you know, eye contact and things like that. Oh. And that's a bit much to me. I'm not here to try and manipulate people or influence people. I have enough trouble with myself. So I like the CBT aspect of it, but I think NLP in its extremes, I think is a bit much. I mean, if you get onto Google and put, you know, NLP and, you know, dream fulfillment, or NLP and overcoming insecurities, you know, what comes up is pretty – you know, some of the sort of over-promising that comes up is bit much, actually. I mean, clearly that's at its most it's at the extremes, but so hence, you know, I do worry that NLP just over promises a bit and starts thinking about how to manipulate others, and you know, and I kind of worries me, you know. Whereas, you know, mindfulness, I know less about mindfulness. It's not really, you know, Buddhism, I know very little about Buddhism. I know a bit about mindfulness, and I don't want to criticize it, because I think it's, you know, I understand stress very well, and anxiety, and you know, I get very, very stressed, and I, you know, and if it can help, then and absolutely, I absolutely embrace it. I think it's a really wonderful thing. And whenever you meet an NLP person, they're kind of, the way they're sort of staring at you and trying to, you know, you feel that they're sort of manipulating you. You see what I mean? And you kind of, you know, you thought, you know, you, it kind of, it's disconcerting in a way. But when you meet a sort of mindfulness person, you just, you know, you want to hug them, you want to take them home, you know, and that's got to be nicer, isn't it? I mean, that's, yeah. You know. That's, you know, so that's what I'd say on that, really. Is, you know, got to remember, guys, I'm, you know, I'm a sufferer, and I'm you know, I'm not, and a researcher, you know, I'm not a practitioner of any of this stuff. I suffered from this greatly and couldn't get beyond it, and then researched it and researched it, and then in my research came up with what I thought was a strong process by which you understood what had happened to you, you accepted it, and then you try to navigate the consequences of it. And I think that, and it's, that's all I'm trying to do. And I will steal from CBT, NLP, mindfulness, Stephen Covey, Anthony Robbins, Brian Tracy, you name it. You know, in order to do that, I will absolutely go for it. And that's pretty much all I've done. It's that I've nicked. Once you get beyond the understanding, and you've got to say, okay, well, what do we do now? As you said, talked about ACT. Then from that moment onwards, I'm a complete magpie. I am absolutely taking bits and pieces from everywhere, because I'm lining up what worked, I think, for the person, for the high FF.
Yeah.
And that's so, this new book is also for high FFs.
Well, it's for people who are underconfident. Obviously, there's a huge overlap there. You know, the key, you know, I'm writing a third book, and that's about getting things done.
Yeah, getting things done.
It's called What's Stopping You Getting Things Done,
right.
And
so
it's.
Ooh.
And that's the one. That's going to be that's writing now.
Yeah. One of my clients has got a system for that. Which is the most simple system I've encountered on getting things done.
Oh, you worry about it, because I'm researching it all now.
It's called inbox control.
Yes, it's a big problem that it's in Norwegian, but but he has been actually so he wanted to write a book, But he's very, I don't know how you do that, but he's very, the publisher said, you know, it's not sellable enough.
No, well.
So he would be very interested in talking to you, I think, if you are making a book.
Absolutely. No, he sounds, you must put him in contact, actually, because I.
Yeah.
Some of that more practical stuff I need help on, because you got right. Let me go into this. What's, if you think about the three books, then you've got What's Stopping You, which is about fear of failure. You've got What's Stopping You Being More Confident, which is about lack of confidence, and you've got What's Getting Things Done, which is about inaction and procrastination. What connects those three things? Well, I think it's low self-esteem. It's basically low self-esteem is the connecting phenomenon in all of it, and so you know, so if there's one malaise in all of it, it's low self-esteem, and it's that you need to attack, and that is certainly my issue. And however it happened, however you ended up that way, that's where you are, and you know, so that's where I come from, and that's where I that, you know, that's the connecting factor with all those three subjects is low self-esteem.
His approach is, he's a doctor, like a general practitioner, and he basically made a system for himself, which in his experience would be best for his brain.
Right. Very good.
So he basically says the brain is a very simple tool. Really, it's not as complex as we maybe. Has been led to believe, and then he just sets up a system. It's deadly simple, and like you said, it's, you know, you gotta start doing stuff.
Yeah,
you know. So yeah, instead
absolutely.
Of
once
just
you got the system,
instead of moving about, you know, prioritizing and planning, and he's like, you set up a simple system. And you just do stuff.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That is pretty much the message I'm adopting. I have to say,
So cool. You're really coming with two more books.
I don't think I'm still writing that one, so I probably voodooed it now, and I'll never get it finished now I've mentioned it. But the second one is written,
it's done.
Yeah, the What's Stopping You Being More Confident is done. That comes out. I mean, that's done and dusted. That comes out in a couple of months. The What's Stopping You Getting Things Done is I'm now writing it.
But so this confidence book, do you have... have you published parts of it yet? Like put on little teasers and stuff out on the internet?
We're just trying to work out what to do on the PR front. Not quite yet. I mean, to be honest, the second edition of What's Stopping You has only just come out, and or it came out in July. So we're still in that kind of focus. And actually came out in August. So it's very new, and we're still focusing on that at the moment. So I haven't really... looked at how I'm gonna go about doing the PR for.
But you have to let us have a look at it.
Yeah, no,
absolutely. And come back to talk to us about it later.
Yeah, you bet. No, absolutely. You bet. That's a date.
Sounds great.
Good.
Hey, Robert, I was gonna ask you. I think we have to wrap up soon, but just. For, like you were saying, you have to run yourself as a company, I guess, Me Inc. So I guess companies, they have lots of ways of measuring progress and figure out where they are and where they want to go. Very briefly, how do you measure progress in Me Inc.?
The way, this is going to give a real taster of what's in the book, which is that visualization. And if you should visualize yourself in 10 years time, a full 10 years ahead, and you should be incredibly detailed about that visualization. But importantly, it's not, you know, for your progress, for Me Inc., it's not just visualize, you know, the house and the dog and the wife, etc. No, what you've got to visualize is what you do, what you're doing with your daily life, not just what the office looks like, but what is it you're doing, you know, in that office or in that work workshop, you know, so what are the processes you're going through in your working life? And it could well be that, you know, if you can't do that, if you have to be material about it, then sort of think of an industry award or something like that that you'd like to win, or some, you know, something that's like, you know, get focused like that. But then what you've done, once you've got the 10-year goal and you've got that visualized, what you then need to do is do the 5-year goal. And you, don't forget, you've got 10 years to get to that goal. So you don't, none of it has to be in place until the, you know, the last day of year 9. So then you go to 5 years and say, well, what has to happen by year 5 in order to meet that 10-year goal? What has to be in place in by year 5? And you get as detailed as you can again. Then go to year 2. What has to happen to make sure you meet that 5-year goal? What has to be in place at year 2? Then do year 1. Then do 6 months. Then do 3 months. Then do 1 month. Then do 1 week. And then do tomorrow. What has to happen tomorrow to meet that 1 week goal? And there you are. There's your process.
Good.
That sounds great.
So
I did that yesterday.
Very good.
Because you had it in your book.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, good.
But not, yeah, you did. You wrote about it in your book, but that was, like you said, the house, the dog, the wife, and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not going to have a dog. I'm sorry. But but I did the others, and I liked it. And now let's see where I end up.
Yeah, yeah, it's great fun. I mean, no, you know, this isn't written in stone. Visualization isn't written in stone. I think I talked about your constitution, you know, and you have to write that. You know, that's kind of written in stone, but it's kind of a once a year thing. But you know, but I think the visualization, yeah, you should, you know, your values may change, and so you need to visualize it constantly. But the point is to have a direction, to be on a path. You know that, you know, to have that path. One thing that people with fear of failure have amazing problems with is actually just taking that next step, because they don't know where that next step is leading them. And so so if you know where it's leading you, then you take it. And if it doesn't work out, you still know that you've got to take the step. Okay, it didn't quite work. You've got to and then you come back and say, okay, well, that didn't work. So how can I do it in order to take that step again? It gives you fantastic judgment. And it also gives you motivation as well. A lot of people talk about willpower. Willpower's rubbish. Willpower will dissipate. The minute the emotions disappear, willpower will just completely dissipate. And that's what happens to people all the time. But if you've got a goal that's set out and you're, you know, for 10 years with you knowing what's going to happen in 1 week and in 1 month and in 3 months, if you know what the all you've got to do is take the steps. You don't need willpower. You just take steps.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there you are.
Excellent.
But we would love to read the book and we won't tell anybody about it. We promise.
Definitely.
Yeah, no, I'm not. Yeah, but I don't know where we are with it at the moment. I think it's still it's not printed yet. It's still in the hands of various people.
We have a printer.
Great.
Oh.
So
I don't.
Well, yeah. When you know, we would love to have a copy, and
we will get you one.
So we're going to. Yeah, let's end now and have a quick chat about stuff after. Do you have time for that?
Yeah, I am slightly running out of time now. I know I said all night. I am now running out of time because I'm on slight bath duty with the kids.
Ooh, okay. But let's
we'll
end
be very
now.
Quick.
Okay, go on. Thank you a lot. This has been great.
Thank you very much. And we'll be back soon. And you can find us on bookcastingpodcast.com and on Facebook, facebook.com/bookcastingpodcast. Okay, see you soon.
Yep.